The next case on our calendar is 08-1980, East of Lucerne and Hall, Estate of Lucerne and Hall, excuse me, versus Akron General Medical Center. Mr. Leek.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Doug Leek, and I am here with trial counsel Stacy Reagan Delgros, and we are here on behalf of Dr. Patterson and his medical group, Radiology and Imaging Services. And we are here asking that this court reverse the erroneous Ninth District opinion and reinstate the defense verdict that was properly rendered in their favor. The Ninth District decision has now redefined the doctrine of res judicata, res ipsa loquitur in the state of Ohio. It has effectively expanded res ipsa loquitur greatly, in which now there is practically guarantees that that instruction can be given in a medical malpractice case. We have provided you with two propositions of law that show that this decision by the Ninth District is legally flawed.
Do we need to define what is direct evidence here? There wasn't any direct evidence here, was there, of any fault?
Well, that will take us to our first proposition of law, and that's where we go to what res ipsa loquitur is. It's premised on circumstantial evidence. And what we have in this case is direct evidence presented by the plaintiffs, by both their experts, Dr. Foley and Dr. Kremen, as to what constituted the deviation from the standard of care by Dr. Patterson.
That direct evidence was, I'm a nurse and I saw the doctor leave something in the opening, or I'm an assistant and I recognize that the anesthesiologist didn't regulate the anesthesia properly. That would be direct evidence. But here we have, these are opinions of doctors who nobody knows exactly what happens. I mean, and so they gave their opinion of what happened. Is that direct evidence?
Well, the direct evidence we're talking about is you have to look at this case in the context of a medical malpractice case. And as this court set forth in Bruni versus Tatsumi, the elements, and that goes to the direct evidence in this case, of a medical malpractice case is that the plaintiffs have to produce expert testimony as to what the standard of care is, whether there was a deviation from the standard of care, and whether that deviation from the standard of care proximately caused injury or death. And so the issue here is whether or not the plaintiffs presented specific evidence on those elements that satisfy their case.
But are they permitted to make an inference of that negligence?
That gets to our whole point in this case, is that the circumstances where a res ipsa loquitur jury instruction would be warranted is when an expert says, I don't know what specific act caused the injury, but I know that this injury only occurs in the presence of negligence. And we don't have that here in this case. What we have in this case is two experts, Dr. Foley, the interventional radiologist, and then we have Dr. Kremen, the vascular surgeon, who testified, both of them testified, that the specific act that constituted the alleged negligence in this case was the withdrawal of the guide wire and the advancement of the dilator during this placement of the catheter. And then they went on to testify with certainty, both of them, with certainty that that act was a negligent act which proximately caused the laceration to the superior vena cava.
So is direct evidence, is a part of the definition of direct evidence how certain the doctor is in giving his or her opinion?
I think using the words certain or, you know, probability, I think the key here is that both experts, they did not testify that we are inferring negligence just because there was an injury to the superior vena cava and that there was death. They did not testify that's how they're making an inference of negligence. They both testify as to a specific act, pulling the guide wire back and the dilator being pushed in and causing the laceration.
And was that act established in the record that it actually occurred? Or was it their opinion that that's what must have occurred?
And that's the key to medical malpractice cases. And we will agree that non-experts are not present in the operating room to provide testimony as to exactly what happened. What they have the benefit of are medical records, depositions, and in this case, the coroner's report. And so it gets back to our position of what direct evidence is.
So did anybody testify to that fact, that the guide wire was pulled out? And did anybody testify to that specifically? Did the physician say, that's what I did? Or is this, again, based upon an opinion?
That's the dispute of the case here, because they offered direct evidence of what they thought happened, and then we offered evidence that that is not what happened.
Okay, but I understand what they thought happened, and it appeared to me that both sides were talking about what they thought happened, but nobody was actually testified to what did happen. And you're talking about the guide wire being, and I guess my question is really simple. It doesn't go beyond what I'm asking. Did the physician that performed the surgery say, I withdrew this guide wire?
Well, you know, Dr. Patterson talked about his procedure, okay? And as our experts testified, he did it by the book based upon his operative note and his deposition. As to your question as to whether or not anyone saw, you know, the laceration of the superior vena cava by the dilator, well, that's in dispute because we're saying that could not have caused the injury and the ultimate death in this case. And I think that's the issue here that we started off with of what constitutes direct evidence, what constitutes specific acts of negligence that you have to weigh in terms of whether a res ipsa loquitur jury instruction is given.
Counsel, to summarize what you've just said, your defense was that the dilator didn't cause this at all.
Exactly.
A weakness that this patient had that led to the injury, and if the dilator didn't cause it at all, it was just fortuitous that it happened. Fortuitous isn't the right word, but it was ironic that it happened at the same time that the dilator was being deployed.
Okay. And I think that takes us into our second proposition of law where we deal with
that issue. Was that your defense?
Causation. We had a defense that a laceration to a blood vessel, or specifically, as the literature said and the plaintiff's experts agreed, that a laceration to the superior vena cava is a known complication that can occur in the absence of medical negligence. And our experts both testify, Dr. Levitt and Dr. Dean.
It doesn't occur, though, in the absence of invasion by an instrumentality, does it?
Well, and I think Dr. Patterson agreed that, you know, if something was improperly inserted and caused a laceration, that could be negligence. But based upon what we know about this patient and the expert testimony we provided equally probable causes to dispute their inference that they were trying to say of negligence. But once again, it wasn't an inference. They were saying that this specific act.
What I'm trying to discern is your defense was not that coincidentally a tear developed at about the same time that this instrument was being deployed. Your defense was that in deploying this instrument, it poked through the wall because the wall was weak due to an infection or...
Exactly. We had two alternative probable causes, one being an abnormal anatomy and two, Staph aureus infection. So that was our defense. And that takes us to the Jennings Buick versus City
of... I might just stop you there for a moment just so I understand this as we go along. The opinion that the artery wall was weak or had a defect, that was not based on an autopsy or anything that actually looked at that, or if it had a flesh-eating bacteria, some test that said there was a flesh-eating bacteria. These were your expert's opinion, based upon their experience, and is that correct?
Exactly, and the review of the records and what happened, and the medical records of the procedure being done by the book. So yes, opinions. And once again, I think that's the issue of a medical malpractice case, that we're saying, yes, a non-expert cannot visualize what happened, okay, and other witnesses may not, but the key in this case is that res ipsa loquitur did not apply because they provided specific opinions with certainty as to the specific act that they say constituted the medical negligence and constituted the proximate cause of injury and death.
So you're saying by virtue of the testimony that the guide wires were pulled back inadvertently or incorrectly, and then that was proffered by the plaintiff's two experts in the discussion, negates the appropriateness of a res ipsa being even part of the case.
Exactly. And what we're referring to on our first proposition of law is Morgan versus Children's Hospital case, is the landmark case in from this court on res ipsa loquitur in medical malpractice cases. And that is the case that said that you can have expert testimony and also res ipsa loquitur in the same case. However, what this court said was that in order to get that instruction on res ipsa loquitur, the circumstantial evidence must support that jury instruction. And that's why we also cite, in conjunction with the Morgan case, the DeMarco versus Bernstein case out of the 8th District that came out 3 years later in 1988, that said that a res ipsa loquitur instruction was not appropriate where the plaintiff's case was premised upon their experts' specific opinions on negligence and proximate cause. And so we rely upon the DeMarco case, which is a classic example of what Morgan stood for when that case was first brought out. And that's proposition law number one.
But now, counsel, is there any really new law to be made here as far as the subject matter goes?
No, I think what we're dealing with is that we have a legally flawed decision, and more glaringly is in the second proposition of law regarding the interpretation of this court's case of Jennings Buick versus City of Cincinnati. And in their opinion, and at paragraph 22 of the Ninth District's decision, they admit that the language of Jennings Buick supports our position, that if we put on, if there's evidence of two or more equally probable causes for the injury, one not being attributable to the negligence of the defendant, you do not get a res ipsa loquitur charge. And that's what we have here.
Well, perhaps, I mean, this is the first time since law school that I've had to look at this issue or think about it. I thought the basic thing was the thing speaks for itself. And in this case, it would be the tear speaks for itself, would it not? I mean, that's the thing in this case.
Well, we don't need that.
Well, just follow me. I mean, yes. If you're applying the doctrine, the thing in this case would be the injury, wouldn't it?
Well, the thing is, we don't say that that injury speaks for itself, that it constitutes negligence. We're saying the injury could be caused by non-negligence.
But if you're going to apply res ipsa, the application is, this is not a sponge found in the closed abdomen. This is an injury. So that's the thing. Now, I didn't think res ipsa meant that you just, plaintiff gets to res ipsa, the plaintiff wins. The defendant still gets to rebut, don't
right.
they?
Well, the problem
is even if res ipsa is in the case, the case isn't over, is it?
Right. But the problem here is that they are presenting evidence of direct, specific acts of negligence that went to the jury. On top of it, the Ninth District is saying they are also entitled to an inference of negligence. And so what we have is direct
but
evidence.
But your witnesses, even if, it, let's say you res ipsa is in, your witnesses still get to say there is an explanation other than negligence.
Right.
And for this injury, and hence we have explained away
Well, and that gets us to the Jennings-Buick case, because we presented evidence of other probable causes not attributable to the negligence of Dr. Patterson. And we stand by Jennings in this case, and the problem is that the Ninth District recognized that Jennings supported our position.
Well, counsel, isn't the real problem is not what you said to rebut the plaintiff's case. It's the fact that the plaintiffs put forth via two experts how this tear occurred. They're not saying we've got a tear and the only way this tear would occur would be via negligence.
Exactly.
And we can't point exactly to what the specific negligent act was, but we know it had to be negligent in order to have this tear. And then the defendant puts on your experts saying he did the procedure by the book, etc. But my understanding is that because they said this is what happened with the guide wire and he was negligent in pulling it back prematurely, that caused, without a doubt, the injury to cause the tear. And if they weren't so certain with their experts' evidence and opining on what happened here, they would have had a better case for res ipsa.
Exactly, and that's the thing. They relied upon their experts to tell the jury this is the act that constituted negligence. This is the negligent act that proximately caused the injury. This is the act that caused the laceration, the injury, and the death. And so, yes, just like the DeMarco versus Bernstein case said in interpreting Morgan versus Children's Hospital, once they start to rely upon their experts for specific opinions, you do not get res ipsa. And I know we have run out of time, but what I would like very quickly to address is the Jennings.
Quickly.
Am I out of time?
Very quickly.
Okay, the Jennings case. We stand by Jennings, but what is most glaring about the legally flawed decision here is their own case of Roberts versus Crow, which is directly on point, rendered in 2005. And the Ninth District acknowledged that the Roberts case relied and quoted the Jennings case. But what did they do at paragraph 27? They overruled the Roberts reasoning, the law. They overruled it, essentially overruling Jennings indirectly to get the result they wanted here. They didn't distinguish their own Roberts versus Crow case. They overruled the law as set forth in Roberts that quoted this court's decision in Jennings-Buick case on the issue of more than two probable causes not attributable to negligence, and that's the case, and that's why Jennings applies.
Thank
to
you,
this
Mr.
case.
Leak.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Flowers.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Paul Flowers. I represent the estate of Lorraine Hall here this morning. I'm joined by Stan Schneiderman and Gary Mankowski, who have been representing the two families for 3 to 4 years now. And they're here to make sure that I don't make a mess of things during this argument. I think I would like to start off with the Chief Justice's question, which dealt with the first proposition of law, whether or not we had direct evidence presented at trial so that there would be no need for a rape or Lokeeter instruction. And the very simple answer to that question is no, there was no direct evidence presented. Even though this argument was never raised in either the trial court or the Court of Appeals, the Ninth District recognized that. There's a line in there where Judge Dickinson writes for the unanimous court, there was no direct evidence presented, and that's absolutely true. Direct evidence is based on personal knowledge. It's that simple. Direct
but did you have experts who gave what they considered to be the specific act of negligence?
Yes.
And my understanding from res ipsa, and I did have it in some trials, is you don't have a specific act of negligence. You don't know why, but the injury could not occur without negligence. And that's not in your case, is it?
No.
So that is an expansion of res ipsa to allow testimony of what you think is the negligent act and an additional instruction that you seek for res ipsa as well.
No, that argument that you, when we have a specific theory of negligence, you don't get res ipsa, that's rejected in Morgan's versus Children's Hospital. Morgan's versus Children's Hospital was issued by this court in 1985, and I believe it's the last word on res ipsa here. In fact, opposing counsel called a landmark decision. In that case, in Morgan, you had a situation where the patient goes in to have his thymus removed, patient dies, Everyone agrees the patient died of oxygen deprivation. The theory of the plaintiffs, to which their experts testify, is that the anesthesiologist was not properly inflating the AMBU bag, and therefore the patient and Morgan did not get enough oxygen and died. That's a very specific theory of negligence. And both the trial court and the appellate court used the theory that you just expressed, that they're hanging their hat on, that once you've got specific negligence, then you don't get res ipsa. And this court said no. This court said if it's set up where you have testimony that one, the instrumentality is in the exclusive control of the defendants, and two, these incidents don't occur but for negligence, then the jury has to be instructed that they can make that step, that although no one was there, although no one knows precisely what had happened because no one's admitting to anything, you can make that step that it was negligence, and that's an important step.
But if you take the Ninth District version, which seems to be an expansion because they did overrule their prior case, basically you will now be entitled to res ipsa instruction in almost every negligent case, will you not?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, you got to meet those two tests. And it really doesn't happen that much because the first one's hard, exclusive instrumentality and control. And then you couple with that with these events don't happen but for negligence. And those two together don't arise that much. So this is a lot of hyperbole that, you know, we're going to have some sort of revolution where this instruction will be given in every case. That's not the case.
But in looking at Jennings, Mr. Flowers, we said there that where it's been shown by evidence adduced, there are two efficient and probable causes of injury, one of which is attributable to the negligence of the defendant, then the rule of res ipsa loquitur does not apply.
Right.
And isn't that what we have in this case? We have the extraction, and then we have the weakened arterial wall, and we have the infection sort of defense. And it seems to me that the expert questions as to the cause were submitted to the jury.
Correct. That sentence that you read from Jennings, which is the one sentence they've extracted from that case and sat on, and it's the one sentence that got the Ninth District in trouble a few years ago in Crow, it's followed up by another sentence. And that sentence reads, in other words, where the trier of fact could not reasonably find one of the probable causes more likely than the other, the instruction of inference of negligence may not be given. So it falls back to, it doesn't matter that they can identify some probable causes. You still get the instruction if your experts say the most probable one is this, and that's what we have here. Jennings Buick, that one sentence by itself, yes, it does seem to suggest that the mere existence of a probable cause, no matter how far-fetched it is, will defeat the res ipsa instruction, but that's not what this court was saying. And this court 5 years later makes that very clear in Morgan. Morgan is a medical malpractice case. Jennings Buick, you know, that was a property damage case dealing with a water leak. They're trying to squeeze in res ipsa loquitur. It was a bad fit. There's probably a lot of reasons why the same result could be reached in Jennings Buick. But in Morgan, the court says flat out, you know, you got expert testimony, doesn't matter, you still get the instruction. That's Morgan versus Children's Hospital. And to accept either of their propositions of law, you have to overrule Morgan's versus Children's Hospital.
Counsel, going back to the line they use and your response to it out of Jennings, the debate about this comes at the end of the trial. Plaintiff has the burden of proof. Your experts, plaintiff's experts, have said the cause is this premature instruction of the wire. I assume they were cross-examined about the defense's theory.
At length, right.
And what did they say or conclude? So what's the state of the evidence in terms of the plaintiff's experts' evaluation of the defense theory?
Well, the two plaintiff's experts, Dr. Foley and Dr. Kremen, both said that this theory Dr. Patterson did everything by the book and this just happened due to a weak vein just wasn't possible. And the reason is because the coroner, during the autopsy, immediately after the death, finds a 4-centimeter laceration. If you have this flesh-eating bacteria that Dr. Dean suggested, or a weak vein like Dr. Levitt said, the vein is going to collapse, unravel, deteriorate. You're not going to get a 4-centimeter laceration. The defendant's experts, their testimony was, Dr. Patterson says he did it by the book, and we believe him. Therefore, the only way this death could occur was because she had some weakness in her system. That was their argument, and, you know, I guess that gets them to a jury and pass a jury.
And what did they say about the defense experts, about the premature extraction of the wire?
Because Dr. Patterson said he did not do that, they believe him. So therefore, that did not happen. That's
okay,
their argument.
But did they opine, if in fact that happened, could that cause the laceration?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Everybody agreed on that.
They agreed that that was possible. So
Dr. Patterson agreed on
that. So where I'm headed with this is you say, well, if it's a 50-50 deal, you don't get res ipsa. But the judge now is having to evaluate plaintiff's testimony, who you've characterized as saying it's not possible, their explanation.
Okay.
And their testimony saying, here's what we think happened because we believe the doctor that he didn't prematurely extract the wire. But would it be fair to say their testimony also was, it would be possible if it is a plausible explanation if he did prematurely extract the wire?
I got to be clear on this because, you know, I don't want to distort the testimony.
Yeah.
They said that it would be possible to cause damage to the vein by prematurely extracting the guide wire. There was some testimony that due to the nature of these injuries, that couldn't have happened here. You know, they did say that.
What I'm driving at is that the trial judge got to balance all of this.
Right. And ultimately the jury.
And so are we down to that as to whether or not the trial judge properly evaluated, is this a 50-50 deal or is this one in which you had to give it because it's not a 50-50?
Right. I think the way Judge Dickinson said it, he said it best in the opinion below, you know, that once you have testimony from the plaintiff meeting these two elements, you have to give the charge. It's up to the jury to decide whether or not the plaintiff's evidence is correct.
So the plaintiff gets the charge because the plaintiff has the burden.
Right. And the defendants,
so they get the benefit of the doubt,
right,
as to whether or not the charge goes in or not.
And defendants are free to argue that, you know, neither of these elements have been met. This is not the testimony. They can argue that the presumption, not the presumption, the inference never applies. And in Morgan, this court, you know, hits squarely on this. This court says, and I'm looking at page 189 of Morgan, it is a well-established principle that a court may not refuse, as a matter of law, to instruct on the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur merely upon the basis that the defendant sufficiently rebuts the making of such an inference. You know, Morgan said it all. So, Justice O'Connor, go back to your question. There is no new law to be made here. You take Jennings Buick, you take Morgan's versus Children's Hospital. That's all you need for established precedent. And yeah, a few years ago, the Ninth District in the Crow case gets caught on that one sentence of Jennings Buick. They make the wrong decision, and they've now corrected it.
But counsel, here you have what in essence is the battle of the experts.
Correct.
You've got two doctors on the plaintiff's side, and one of them is opining that he knows exactly what happens. He's no ambiguities, no other possibilities. He is emphatic in his language about that is exactly what happened in this case. And he goes on to describe how this injury typically could occur. And again, he's not looking at tissue firsthand or any of that sort of stuff. So he's based it on records. Then you have your other doctor, the second expert for the plaintiff. Then you've got the two experts for the Dr. Patterson here, one of whom says that he didn't believe any of the dilators were even long enough to have occurred that kind of an injury here.
Right.
So you do have, I guess, an issue of evaluation and credibility for the jury, which I'm not clear on why res ipsa would have been thrown in here and why this is not like any other battle of the experts and let the jurors weigh the credibility and the evidence?
Well, you're right on all that. It's a battle of the experts case, and it comes down to credibility. But the key feature of this case, which makes it a textbook res ipsa case, is that you've got that same scenario where everything's in the control of the surgeon, and this is the type of injury that won't happen but for negligence. There are lots of situations where a patient will either die or suffer an injury during
would
a procedure.
Would you agree that if there was a weakness in the vein, that that would not have been, and the procedure was done in the textbook, according to the textbook, that that weakness, that inherent weakness in the vein, would not be an act of negligence?
Correct. That makes sense to me.
Okay. And that is what, basically, I'm hearing the experts for the defendant say.
Right.
So when you say it's res ipsa is appropriate because of the exclusive control in the hands of the defendant here, that's not sufficient because there's the theory here, or at least the expert opinion, let's call it, that had to be an inherent weakness in the vessel.
Right. See, Adam, I'm running low on time, but here's my response to that. The key problem with that theory is that a laceration was found. When you have a weakness in the vein, it deteriorates. The 4-centimeter laceration is a big problem for that theory because it doesn't make sense. You don't find lacerations when you've got a deteriorating vein or a flesh-eating bacteria. The vein, the injury, the laceration speaks for itself. That is res ipsa. You don't get that kind of injury without negligence.
The difficulty I have with that argument, though, Mr. Flowers, is stemming from Jennings, and it's referenced in several cases. It appears to me as though the plaintiff is offering a specific theory of negligence, specific evidence of what had occurred that caused the injury, which was rebutted by the defendant. And then the plaintiff has sort of an alternate theory of circumstantial evidence that it had to be anyway.
Right.
And you don't really get the inferential circumstantial charge when you have specific evidence of negligence. That's not our law.
Well, that was what was filed in Morgan's versus Children's Hospital, though. You have a very specific theory of negligence there. That very argument is raised that, hey, we've got expert testimony. We don't need res ipsa. And this court rejects that. And this court wasn't going out on a limb in Morgan. I mean, this court cited cases from all over the country reaching the same result. You know, the thing that gets me is this because it's certain, it's direct, and we don't need res ipsa. I mean, in medical malpractice cases, you always need medical certainty. You always have to have that element. And by their argument, you'd never have a res ipsa charge in medical
malpractice. Why wouldn't that always be a catch-all then in every medical malpractice case? The second theory is, well, we're not sure we can prove what we think happened, but even if we don't, we'll just throw this in and see if somebody will say, well, there's an inference that it happened, so it's good enough.
Yeah, I think if you stand up in front of a jury and say,
that's
we don't know
what happened.
That's
a good smile you got on your face, by the way.
Excuse me?
Good smile, yeah. Why wouldn't that
just
happen, though?
If you stand up in front of a jury and say, we don't know what happened, res ipsa, you're asking for trouble. You're not going to win that case. I think res ipsa is not like that. Res ipsa says, we weren't there. Nobody who was there is fessing up. It's not fair for us to have to prove exactly what's going on when there was no way we could have. They're in exclusive control, but what we can show is these things don't happen without negligence. And it's that step that the jury needs to know, that they can take that, these things don't happen, we don't get these 4-centimeter lacerations without negligence, and then infer negligence from that. That's the step they need.
But that's the thing. It's you don't get it without negligence, like the sponge in the body. There's no question. You don't get it without negligence. And here, when you have the competing theories of how it can be got, how it can happen without negligence, the limited rule of res ipsa appears to not apply. That's the problem that
I'm
having.
I agree with you all the way up to the last part there, but I think all those things you say, it does apply because they've got their theories. They've got flesh-eating bacteria and so forth, but we need to say, hey, this 4-centimeter laceration speaks for itself. It wouldn't be there if this had been done by the book. You can infer negligence from that. That's what the jury needed to know here.
Thank you, Mr. Flowers.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Leake, you've used your time, which may take 30 seconds.
Let me first start by finishing the quote in the Morgan case. Yes, this court said that direct evidence doesn't preclude a res ipsa locator charge, but it continued and said, so long as the evidence supports an instruction because there's circumstantial evidence. That's it. That was the key of Morgan, circumstantial evidence. Their case wasn't circumstantial. It was specific. But more importantly, the Jennings case and the misapplication of Jennings, we cited two cases, Brokamp, Bowden from the 1st District, the Hager case from the 8th District. We cited the 6th District DeMoore case and the Roberts case, the 9th District's only case on probable causes not attributable to negligence.
Counsel, I'm still having trouble figuring out how Jennings involving broken water main and a later case, Morgan, involving a hospital operating room, why Morgan isn't dispositive here.
Well, I think you have to, that's why we have two propositions of law. Morgan deals with our proposition of law dealing with the fact that they put on direct evidence of a deviation from the standard of care. You go to Jennings, which is more proximate cause as to two or more probable causes. So you can look at them together because both cases are cited throughout all those medical malpractice cases that we've referenced and the Roberts case. And so the Jennings case is probable cause. And we actually put on evidence to dispute their theory because the dilator could not have caused this laceration based upon their testimony to that effect because it's a rigid instrument and can't make that curve. So we disputed that, and based upon the autopsy findings of ongoing injury to her vessels, we put on the probable cause, not attributable negligence, is that in the best of hands, the best procedure done by the book, this injury can occur because it's a known complication, which is in the literature, in the pamphlet that went with it, which the plaintiff's experts actually acknowledge. And so that's why both we are not, that they don't get a res ipsa under Morgan versus Children's, and they don't get a res ipsa under Jennings. And the trial court properly let this go to the jury and let them weigh the evidence and the credibility of the witnesses, and that's why the defense verdict should stand, because this is an issue that was left to the jury, and they should not have been allowed to make an inference on top of it.
Thank you, Mr. Leake. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.